This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Mark Neeson about a memoir he's written called Schoolhouse, Lessons on Love and Landscape. How are you, Mark?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Thanks for the invite. This is a real honor, David.
Well, it's a really interesting book. You know, memoir is tricky sometimes, I think. There's the whole issue of when you must, I assume, because this is a memoir of your life, while people who are in it are still around, you have to think about the people whose story surrounds your own, which I think, that can be tricky because, there are people that you don't want to, whose feelings you might not want to hurt. So I always wonder about that with memoir. You know, how do you handle
Well, sure, that is an issue, and you have to sort of really make sure that you're aware of those things. I mean, there are some memoirs out there that you'll read that you could feel that there's a part about them that seems like they're trying to even scores or things like that. So you do have to make sure that your intentions are good, that you're not trying to do anything like that, that you're not speaking out of some other ulterior motive going on. But yeah, there is the component of, there are people around you and some people will read it differently than you intend. And that's also something that you have to deal with, but that's, my wife's father used to say something, just because you stick your neck out doesn't mean that someone's going to pet it. And I think there's a part of memoir writing that there is a risk value there. There is something. And, and I check with a lot of people too. You run the work by them and you say, look, can you live with this? And there's the component. Sometimes people think that, oh my God, who has to die before I write it? And then who will die if I write it? And I think they're both sort of extremes. People can handle more than you think they can.
Well, and although this book, as you say in the subtitle, it's about love and landscape as the other side of it. The landscape part is the personal for you, the kind of environment within which the conversation with yourself goes on. But the love part is with you and other people. I mean, it obviously there is love of landscape and love of surroundings that might not be so fraught, but I think, part of this was your, and of course I don't want to give away to potentially readers what happened. So I won't talk about it too much, but it is about you wrestling with your situation at a certain point in your life. So that kind of, that makes it complex.
Yeah. And I don't think the landscape part of it is any less complex. I mean, you're really trying, or at least in this case, I was trying to do honor to a particular landscape, a particular part of a plot of land that I was trying to represent well, and the people that were involved with stewarding that land also. So I think that in that case, I felt equally as responsible and accountable to that.
So when the book takes place, this piece of land is in Iowa, near Iowa City. And, this was part, you talk about how you got there. It, it was kind of the going there was part of the evolution of your life. But it was not a place that you had been before. This is, you're an East Coast kind of urban guy who shows up in the Midwest for the first time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was from Brooklyn or suburbia at most, and then coming out into the heart of the corn, and this particular plot of land was like 500 acres of mostly woodland and pasture and pretty rare landscape in that part of Iowa, which is the whole of Iowa is like over 90% farmed, so it was pretty rare land about 15 miles outside of Iowa City.
Right. And this was the property belonged to originally, well, not originally, but the property belonged to the Borgelis when they had lived there. When did they buy the land?
If memory serves, I believe it was in 1964 that they purchased the land.
And the house that you lived in, or the building you lived in, was a one-room schoolhouse that had been there for maybe, you know, 80, 90 years by the, or maybe less by the time you got there. But
actually, yeah, less, because it hadn't been on that exact spot up on the top of that hill. It had been down near the road, but then they had it moved up to that spot, and it became what was Vance Bourgeli's writing studio. And then I somehow managed to luck into being able to live there. And I knew when I lived there that it was an amazing opportunity, and I knew I wouldn't probably ever live like that again. Even at that time when I was living there, I just sensed it.
And were you there only for a year, or was it longer?
It was a little bit longer. The book ends up being focusing on one particular calendar year, but I lived there a little under 2 years altogether.
And of course, at some point during that year, Tina decided that she had to sell the property. It was because she got older and didn't want to live so far from town, it seems like.
Well, I think, and I don't know if it was the living far from town part. I think she was very self-sufficient, and I think it was just that, you know, after nearly 30 years, she was getting a little older, and the amount of physical energy that took out of her in keeping up on the land was something that she started to see. You know, I think there needs to be another path that she needed to take, and I totally understood that, and it was a very noble path also, because she wanted to make sure that the land remained more or less the way it was, and she managed to sell it to the Department of Natural Resources, and you know, the land is still there. The schoolhouse, unfortunately, isn't there anymore, but the land still is there, and I visit it almost yearly. I'm out in Iowa in the summer teaching.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because you do mention, you know, it's sort of funny. I had to go back to the beginning of the book to, you know, when you start a book, often by the time you get to the end, you know that you've gone on this journey, but you have to go back to the beginning, because things that didn't resonate at the beginning of the story are more resonant later after you've read the whole thing. So I noticed that you mentioned that the land, you know, you've been to the land and it's no longer, the building is no longer there. And I was really curious what happened to it. You know, did they just tear it down and get rid of it? Or was there any sense that it was a kind of historic structure that, you know, had, I mean, because you, I mean, it's funny in a way that you went back and explored the story of the building of, you know, how that school was erected and who the teachers were and who the students were. And it just felt like you brought that school into the present. And I was wondering what had become of it.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that it did feel like it was present and alive for you. And that was the other thing I felt accountable to was, you know, I had this incredible fortune. I was trying to think about how could I share that with other people now that the building wasn't there. I mean, I don't feel like I actually have lost the building. It's within me. But, you know, everyone else who's reading it may not have had that opportunity. What was your question again? I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just curious to know whether when they took the building down,
was there a sense of,
you know, did they feel like, you know, and I know that in a lot, you know, in lots of places, you know, this is America, you know, we tear the past down, but there, you know, and there are buildings that are meaningful that are, you know, people care about, but then they're just gone.
A lot of people that cared about it. I mean, unfortunately, it started to fall into disrepair, and just the particulars of how the arrangement was with the DNR, they didn't necessarily have control of the building, and then there was a porch that sort of, or a deck that ran around it, and that had started to fall apart, and somebody fell through it, so then suddenly it became an issue of insurance, and so they were... they said, we need to raise the building. And believe me, I tried, and some other people tried, to see if we could get someone else to move it off the property and put it somewhere else. And it fell through, put it that way. And that's what, you know, I mean, there, at some point in Iowa alone, there were some 14,000 of these schoolhouses. So, you know, there were a number of them, and I don't know, it would be interesting to find out how many still stand now, but I know Mary Swander, that's another writer. She wrote a book on her schoolhouse, and she lived right in the middle of Amish country, about maybe 7 miles down the road from where my schoolhouse was. And hers is still there. She's still living there. And I actually did a reading, a sort of duet schoolhouse reading with her back in October. And that was quite lovely. So, you know, I would agree. There are a lot of things that fall to the wayside. And then there are some things that get preserved. But, I mean, nothing gets really special and lasting unless something else doesn't last in a way. So it's part of that natural process that some things manage to live and some things die, and buildings do die. They really do, you know.
No, that's true. No, I know a photographer who goes to Iowa almost every year taking photographs of buildings and landscapes, you know, and seeing how they change, which buildings survive, which ones go away. You know, that's kind of part of the narrative of his photography. So,
yeah, and keeping a document of that is really important.
Yeah. Well, so this was somewhere, this took place in about 1992. Is that right?
Correct.
And so kind of maybe you could talk just a little bit about what kind of pushed you to go at that particular time in your life to Iowa, to the Writers' Workshop. You know, it's obviously it's who you've become. You've become a writer, but that wasn't maybe so obvious at that time. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what it was that called you to go to Iowa.
Yeah, well, I had you're right. I was bouncing around through a lot of different kinds of jobs in my 20s, and at some point I'd actually went and I was living in Italy, and that was when I started to try and write. I was mostly a visual artist or photographer working in film prior to that, and I can't even remember specifically how it happened, but I think it was some article I'd read in the New York Times that said something about Iowa writing, and so and it turned out they were just talking about the summer writing program, and I shouldn't say just, it's an amazing festival that's offered. It's I guess it's called the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, and I've been teaching for that for, you know, over 20 years at this point. And so I had gone to it as a student for a week, and it was the first time in my life I'd sat in a room full of other people that were trying to do the same thing and weren't apologizing for it or having to explain that, and it was amazing. And then I ended up saying, well, maybe I want to try and actually study this. And so I looked into Iowa, and they were very, the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and they were very kind and talked to me on that trip and said, well, here's a list of all the other schools in the country as well, because this is very competitive. And so I started looking elsewhere, where I might have been more interested geographically, which was places like Montana or in the Southwest in Arizona. And I don't know, just looking at the faculty that were there, a lot of them had come out of Iowa. And I said, well, maybe this is a source somehow. And I was lucky enough to get in the program. And so that's why, that was one of the reasons why I wound up going there. The other reason, as I end up talking in the book, has to do with sort of a long relationship I had had in New York City that I was, to some extent, on the lam from when I went to Iowa. So that was part of me was like going towards something, and part of me, I think, was also running from something. And the two found confluence on this property, you know, and I was sort of living a somewhat Walden-esque life. You mentioned about the book having taken, you know, when it's set, and the truth is I had started writing it back around that time. This is over a 20-year project for me, actually, and it sat on the shelf for a long time, and then I came back to it actually realizing after the new millennium, suddenly it seemed like being in seclusion like that without any kind of contact, which was, you know, not hard in 1992 before cell phones and everything was going on. Suddenly it seemed like this actually could be, I might be able to talk about something that, you know, it's not topical anymore, but actually maybe it does have something to say to the current readership, what it meant to try and isolate yourself, what it meant to try and disappear, if you will. And I think it is finding an audience now. I think there's it has sort of a little bit of that snow globe kind of feel to it.
Well, that's true. I think there's that sense, and it's, you know, there is a certain romanticism that you feel anytime anyone brings up Thoreau, which you have to be careful about, I think. But there is, you know, the impulse to go away to find yourself is pretty strong, I think, yeah. You know, and especially today, as you mentioned, you know, the kind of all-encompassing feeling we have about our connectedness, you know, does make it even that much more interesting or necessary to find solitude. Hard. I mean, it's hard to do. So I think the interest there is in, for a reader anyway, and this is kind of interesting because it brings up one of the things that you talked about in the book that I thought was interesting was the Frank Conroy, who was one of the teachers at Iowa, created this kind of semicircular continuum of the arc of the relationship between the reader and the writer, and right. which you talk about in the book. I'm not going to, you know, you probably talked about it better in the book than I am going to be able to do. So, but I thought that that is kind of the description of how it works to read a memoir as well, you know, that you have to place yourself, you have to make yourself available enough to the reader for us to find entry point, to become sympathetic and understand what it was that you were going through in your process at that time. So it can't just be diary. It has to be constructed in some way, which you just alluded to, that, you know, it took maybe 20 years or longer before you had the distance on the experience to be able to make sense of it.
Yeah, and probably also to be able to write it from a standpoint of connection. I think, you know, I can't really say I went there with a clear sense of, oh, I'm going to find myself here. I was mostly going, oh, how do I disconnect from where I've been? And then it was through the landscape and through what I came to learn being in that space that allowed me to feel at least like I'd found a place where I belonged. But it did take a long time for me to, I mean, you talked about that arc, and the arc is about finding a way of having connection with your reader and finding a story that can be somewhat communal and, as you say, not just about your own diaries or your own belly button lint, and you have to find something that speaks to other people as well. And that did take a while, and I was someone who was more comfortable with being disconnected and finding a way toward intimacy and being able to be vulnerable on the page took a while. It did take a while, and it took as long as it took. You know, I'm not some people. There's a lot of people that have been waiting on this book for a long, long time, and you know, I have no regrets for how long it took. It took however long it had to take to be able to write honestly and vulnerably, I'd say.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it is interesting to think about that word intimacy. You know, in the context of being alone. I mean, and of course, you're not only alone in this book. You're, you know, you're in classes with other students. You're, you know, having relationships with people around you in the neighborhood, and you're still kind of trying to figure out how to relate to the woman that you were still, you know, in some way connected to, and you know, the friend who is also, you know, in your story, the guy, the Italian friend who ends up dying. All of those are with you all the time, so you're not completely in solitude. But
right. I don't claim to it into being that. I think I'm comfortable. You know, most writers are comfortable sitting in a room alone. You know, that which again is something that's getting harder and harder to do in the culture. But you know, I think I have a certain temperament that's built towards that. But I don't think I'm like any other human. And if I was 3 months without being able to talk to anybody, you start to go nuts. You know, we're hurting animals on some level.
That's true. Although, it is always the tension for any writer is that ability to turn away from the social. You know, I was just reading about F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda. They have, you know, I live in Connecticut, and they actually spent 6 months in Westport, Connecticut in 1919, at the period of time when they were being their most social, you know, partying, drinking, doing all this stuff. And you always wonder, how does a writer manage the intense social and the necessary disconnection to be able to sit in front of a type in that era, a typewriter, in our era, the computer. You know, you it's between you and the page, you and the screen. That's such a different experience than being with people.
Oh yeah, it's all about getting quiet and alone in your head. You know, there's a certain amount of apocrypha around people like Fitzgerald and that period of time now, which, of course, if you think of the 20s, was an extremely social period of time. And now we have a different kind of social interaction that's happening online a lot. But for the most part, you know, I lead an extremely boring life. I mean, I think some people tend to think that writers are, you know, have these highfalutin social lives, but most of the ones I know, you know, they have to spend a lot of time alone, and mostly they're trying to create a life that allows for that, you know.
Right.
While at the same time finding somebody to share it with you who understands what creative process involves.
Well, and you have to have experience, and you also have to have solitude. So it's an interesting... Right. conundrum to balance those two. Now, this memoir is not the only kind of writing you do. You obviously have, you write fiction as well. When you were working on this book, did you set aside everything else? Did this become the only project, or were you going back and forth between writing this book and writing other things?
Yeah, that's kind of, I've told you it took over 20 years, so obviously I couldn't have just been working on this, and there was a good 15 years that the book sat on a shelf, waiting for me to actually be able to approach it. There's a main character who's in the book was someone whose name I couldn't even write on the page for, it was just her initial S for many drafts. So, obviously I was writing other things at the same time, doing, you know, I write screenplays as well with I collaborate with a friend of mine, and then he directs them, and I was writing short stories and novels. You know, you sort of find ways to sort of balance out your scheduling on things, but often it is good to focus on one project. I mean, everybody works differently. Some people like to work on more than one project at a time. It helps them. But I sort of didn't work on this book longer than I did work on this book, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
In the last couple of revisions that I did on it, I was putting all my focus on that. But the life of your process is something that you have to, sort of negotiate, and you also have to be attentive to how that process changes too as you get older.
So, and you also are a professor. You teach writing and run an MFA program. How does that affect your ability to or your time management? I should probably say, you know, it, because it's very, you know, it is kind of time-consuming and attention-giving and energy-giving to teach. I mean, that is a really major issue for a lot of writers today, I think, who make their livings as teachers but then have to find a way of writing at other times.
Right, right. Well, I mean, it's a double-edged sword there. I think they wouldn't be able to live the life of a writer unless they were teaching. It's, for better or worse, it's become our patron system over the years. And I would probably say during the school year when I'm teaching, I would think of myself primarily as a teacher more than I would a writer in many respects. You do have to sort of figure out your time. But I think why I write I mean, why I teach, I think, is well, in certain respects, I don't think I'm actually trained to be able to do anything else functional out there in the world. But I think it's nice to be able to give something back, to be able to at least a couple three nights a week to actually be social and be involved with other people and to see what, you know, see also what the current generation is thinking about and what kind of writing they're trying to do. And it's different, you know, every generation is different. But I enjoy teaching a lot. I think it's something I've been able to find a way in to do well. And I don't think of them, I don't think they're mutually exclusive, obviously. A lot of people are doing them, but they do require different focuses, and that's the thing I think that one has to negotiate, and also to be able to make sure that you're getting enough reading time is almost more important.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I think that is really the hardest thing for. I mean, it's not just for you. I think for all of us, and especially when you're teaching, you're reading your students' work. But you still have to read other things. It's, you know, it's so important to kind of continue the discourse and the dialogue between your own mind and the work of others. I think that is really, it's critical.
Right, and also to be able to, you know, it's like for your own work to improve, you just have, you know, it's like playing, you get on a tennis court, you play with someone better than you, you're going to play better.
And that makes you better. That's right.
One of the dangers of teaching is that you are reading work by people that are not yet, you know, they're still emerging and they haven't worked the craft. And to some extent, as a teacher, you can only teach what you already know. But so you do have to find a balance of making sure you are reading work that is stronger than your own, and to help push you, to help teach you something new.
So who are, you know, you mentioned in the book James Allen McPherson mm-hmm. as someone who influenced you as a teacher. You know, are there, who are the other people, not only, I mean, some maybe who taught at Iowa, but others that have influenced you as a writer, whose work and whose ideas you think are important?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that changes over time, too. Early on, I think I was very moved by such people as Gabriel Garcia Marquez and John Edgar Wideman and, Salman Rushdie, Jeanette Winterson. These are all still people that still speak to me in their work. One of the things that also I think would be nice mentioning is that I'm probably influenced a lot by visual artists too, maybe even more than I am by other writers. And that's just something that I was drawn to early in my life. And it just has a different effect on me. I don't always come out of reading a chapter and going, oh my God, I got to go write. But when I come out of a museum, I always feel like, man, I got to just go make something. So that's something that it's important for people to recognize that influences come from elsewhere. Or I tend to work orally also to an extent, so I have certain soundtracks sort of in my head when I'm writing. I have, you know, it's like, oh, I know this scene has to have this kind of emotion to it, and so there's a Tom Waits song in my head, or there's a Arvo Pärt composition that's in my head, depending upon what the mood is that I'm working on, and those are things that I would say have a lot of influence on me as well, or at least on my process.
So I wonder if I'm thinking just as you're saying that the, you know, the Iowa landscape, you know, the ability to immerse yourself in the, you know, the natural world and the stimuli of all of that information, I wonder if that kind of relates to your, you know, your auditory and visual arts interest.
Yeah, and just the whole sensual thing. I mean, the woods walks were a big part. I mean, I live within a city now, so they're not part of my daily routine, but I try and bring them to bear for myself. I think that's a large, I don't know if it's so much of an influence so much as it feels like my church in a way. Going out into the woods is a place that I find a lot of power, let's say. But there's, you know, there's all kinds of ways in which we find work that enthralls us, and makes us want to get involved with that dialogue. I think, I mean, you mentioned about landscape. There was landscape, and I think there was also sculpture too. I mean, I think sculpture and architecture are two things that taught me a great deal about narrative structure. Probably more than a lot of the craft books, the writing craft books that I'm looking at, just because, you know, on some level, we are, our narratives do exist in time and space, and it's a three-dimensional world that you're creating on the page. And I do a lot of thinking in the area of shape and enclosures and what is an armature that can make a story stand up. And that's just some different ways that you start mixing around the language, because, you know, the some of the workshop language does start to lose its power. You mentioned the word arc earlier, and I don't think anybody, I think it's almost common currency, that term now, and the way it's used. And sometimes you have to mess around with the language a little bit just to help yourself re-see things.
No,
or at least I've been doing that with students, and they find that helpful.
Yeah, which, so you sort of take them out of the realm of the, you know, kind of traditional notion of what a narrative is, and think about it in a different, which is difficult, I think, for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, we're all working with the same things in certain respects, and you know, you're just using different media, and to recognize that someone who's trying to make a song work, or is trying to make a building stand up, is in many ways dealing with the same kind of problem solving questions that they're having to work out, and I think it allows it's, at least I can speak for myself, it's allowed me a tangential entry into looking at the work again and helping to revise it and helping to recognize that it is something I'm molding and shaping, and it's not something I can't handle. It's something that I'm there to, I'm the maker, and that's helpful. And so there are moments when that's very helpful, when you feel very very lost in the process.
Yeah, it's sort of making me think that maybe algebra is the, you know,
that far I can't go. I'm sorry on that one.
Well, because, you know, I was thinking music and architecture are both in some ways mathematical expressions. Sure. You know, we don't, and it's just interesting to think of that. If we were smart enough, you know, you could probably figure that out, but yeah. I don't think I am.
It's questions of balance too, you know. Balance very much so comes into a narrative. And we call it a composition for a reason, I think.
You know? Ah, yeah, right. No, that's a good point. Well, it's been fun talking to you. I really enjoyed it. And I should say, I want to make sure I point out that I really liked reading Schoolhouse. I think it's a really fine book, and it was one that made me think and feel, and I appreciated that. So... thanks.
I'm glad. I mean, that was my ultimate intent. Is you know, if you don't make that connection with the reader, you know, then why bother? Why bother?
It's true. Well, and that's what we're here for, right?
Right.
So, well, thank you so much, Mark Neeson.
It was my pleasure, David. Really, thank you so much for all that you do.
Thanks. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Mark Neeson about his memoir, Schoolhouse, Lessons on Love and Landscape.